could not look away. "Ask it if it says anything about elevation," Berenice said breathlessly. Sanchia blinked, startled. "Huh? What?" "Ask the rig if it needs anything about elevation." "I told you it doesn't respond well to my question." "Just do it." Sanchia did so. She shut her eyes, then opened them and said, "It doesn't seem to know what elevation even is." "Perfect," cried Berenice.
"Is it?" asked Sanchia.
"It's one less hole I need to fill," said Berenice, scribbling away. Orso walked up and looked over Sanchia's shoulder.
"We've done our part. Where are we here?"
Berenice peered through a massive magnifying lens at the third definition plate. She wrote one last string in her tiny script, then set the plate aside and picked up the fourth empty one. She said, "Three done, one left."
"Good," said Orso. "I'll load them into the test lexicon."
He took the definition plates away. Sanchia kept her eyes and her hands on the gravity rig. But as she heard Orso clinking and clanking away behind her, the rig suddenly glowed brighter and brighter, and then it started talking to her.
"Location of mass is currently null," said the rig with a mad cheer. "Density of mass? Define density of mass in order to enforce effects, please. Levels of, unable to define levels of density of mass."
"Oh my God," she said lowly. "It's working." "Excellent," said Berenice. "What's it asking for now?"
"I think it wants to know how dense the mass is. In other words, it wants to know how much of a force to effect on the item touching the plates." She swallowed.
"Which will be my body." Berenice paused and sat back. "Ah, well, I have a question for you here."
"Yeah?"
"I don't have time to make really fine controls, so you're going to have to tell the plates the density of this mass. How fast you want to go, basically," said Berenice. "You'll have to tell it, say, that there are 6 Earths in the sky, and then you'll be pulled up at 6 times the rate of Earth's gravity minus Earth's own actual gravitational effects. See?"
Sanchia furrowed her brow. "So you're saying there's a huge scrumming margin of error here?"
"Unimaginably huge."
"And what's the question you have for me?" said Sanchia.
"I actually don't have a question," said Berenice. "I just wanted to tell you all this without you immediately panicking."
She went back to work.
"Great,"
said Sanchia faintly. Another hour ticked by, then another. Orso kept an eye on the Michiel clock tower out the window.
6 o'clock, he said nervously.
"Almost finished," said Berenice.
"You keep saying that. You said that an hour ago."
"But I mean it this time."
"You said that an hour ago, too."
"Orso," said Sanchia, "shut the hell up and let her work." Another sigil. Another massive sheaf of parchment. Another dozen styli ruined. Another dozen inkpots and bowls of melted bronze. But then, at 8 o'clock, Berenice paused, squinting through the lens. Then she sat back and sighed, looking exhausted.
I think I'm done."
Orso grabbed the definition without a word, ran to the text lexicon, put it in, and turned it on.
"Sanchia," he called. "How's it look?"
The rig now glowed bright in her hands, but not solidly bright. It wasn't a complete rig, in other words, just most of one. But from what Berenice had said, they might not need the whole thing.
"Define location and density of mass in order to achieve effect," said the rig with manic happiness.
Her belly squirmed with anxiety. She wanted to make sure she understood how this thing worked before she told it what to do. "Tell me how I make you work."
"First we must decide location of mass," squealed the plates.
"What's mass?"
"Mass is largest thing. Nearly all flow is directed toward largest thing."
"Okay,
then must define the strength of flow of largest thing. All matter falls toward largest thing along direction of flow.
She was beginning to understand. Location is up, she said.
Great, said the plates. Very unconventional. And density?
Density is 1/2 of regular Earth density? Can that work?
Sure. Want me to implement effects now?
Yes.
Done.
Instantly, Sanchia's stomach swooped unpleasantly, like she had a live mouse running around in her intestines. Something had changed. Her head felt heavy, much like her blood was being pulled up into her skull.
Well?
Said Orso impatiently. Sanchia took a breath and stood up. But then, she just kept going. She stared around, terrified, as her body rose up toward the ceiling at a steady pace. It wasn't fast, but it felt fast, probably because she was panicking. Oh my god, she said. Holy shit, somebody grab me! They did not grab her. They just stared.
Looks like it works, yeah,
said Gio. To her relief, she started to come back down again, but she seemed to be falling toward a big stack of empty metal bowls on a nearby table. Shit, she said. Shit, shit. She kicked around helplessly, and they all watched as she slowly, inevitably collided with the pile of bowls, which went crashing and clanging all over the workshop. End effects, Sanchia shouted at the rig.
Done.
Instantly, the lightness died inside her, and she crashed onto the table and fell to the ground. Berenice, delighted, stood up and punched a fist into the air.
Yes, yes, yes! I did it, I did it, I did it!
Sanchia, groaning, stared up at the ceiling.
This is what she's going to do to stop Estelle? Said Gio. She's going to do that? Let's call this, said Orso, a qualified success.
An hour later, and they reviewed their plan.
So, we have what we need, said Orso, but we still need to get our empty box within 1.5 miles of the mountain. That's the farthest the gravity rig will work.
So we still need a way through the walls? Said Claudia. Into the campo?
Yes, but only a bit, said Orso. 1/4 mile or so.
Claudia sighed. I don't suppose Sanchia could use the rig to jump over the walls and open the gates from the inside.
Not without getting shot to bits, said Gio. If the whole campo's locked down, the guards at the gates will shoot anyone who gets close.
Sanchia held the gravity plates in her hand, whispering to them and listening to them respond. Then she sat up. I can get us past the walls, she said quietly. Or through them, rather. How? Said Berenice. A gate is just a door, she said. And Clef taught me a lot about doors. I just need to be able to get close. She sat up and looked around the workshop. She spied something she'd seen the last time she'd been here, when she'd searched the workshop for the listening rig. Those rows of black cubes over there, the ones that seem to suck up light, are those stable? Orso looked around, surprised.
Those? Yes, they're loaded in one of the main Dandolo Foundry lexicons, so you can take those almost anywhere.
Can you attach them to a cuirass or something wearable? She asked. It'll be damn handy if I'm a moving blot of shadow in the darkness.
Sure, said Orso. But why?
I'll need them to sneak up to the East Candiano walls, said Sanchia. Then I'll get things started. Berenice, Orso, I'll need you to have your magic box loaded onto a carriage and ready at the southwest gates. All right? You're going to run along the entire Candiano walls? Said Claudia. Most of them, said Sanchia softly. We'll need a distraction, and I can give us a good one. Gio studied the black cubes.
What are those for, Orso? I've never seen someone scribe light like that before. I made those for Ophelia Dandolo, said Orso. Some secret project of hers. Gregor mentioned she'd made some kind of assassin's lorica out of the things. A killing machine you can't see coming.
Geo whistled lowly.
It'd be handy to have one of those tonight.
Sanchia sank down in her chair. What I'd prefer more, she said, is to go to war with the one person who has the most experience in waging it. But he's been taken from us. She sighed sadly. So, we'll just have to make do. Chapter 35. Darkness whirled around him. There was the crunch of wood, the crackle of glass, and somewhere, a cough and a whimper. Gregor. The scent of putrefaction, of pus, of punctured bowels and hot, wet earth. Gregor? The swirl of water, the sound of many footfalls, the sound of someone choking. Gregor. He felt something in his chest, something trembling, something squirming. There was something inside him, something alive, something trying to move. At first he was horrified. But though he could not really think, how could he think as he was lost in the darkness, he started to understand. The thing moving in his chest was his own heart. It was beginning to beat, first gently, anxiously, like a foal taking its first steps. Then its beats grew stronger, more assured. His lungs begged for air. Gregor Dandolo breathed deep. Water burbled and frothed in countless passageways within him, and he coughed and gagged. He rolled onto his side. He was lying on something, some kind of stone slab, and vomited. What came forth was canal water. That he could tell by the taste. And a lot of it. Then he realized. His stomach. It had hurt so much. Just a bit ago. Yet now it didn't hurt at all. There we are, dear. Said his mother's voice from somewhere near him. There we are.
Mother,
he slurred. He tried to see, but there was something wrong with his eyes. He could only make out streaks and shadows.
Where are you?
I'm here. Something in the shadows moved. He thought he saw a human figure, robed and carrying a candle, but it was hard to see. I'm here right beside you, my love.
What happened to me?
He whispered. His voice was a crackling rasp.
Where am I? What's wrong with my eyes?
Nothing, she said soothingly. He felt a touch on his brow, her soft, warm palm against his skin. They'll get better soon. They just haven't been used for a bit. He blinked. He realized his eyes felt cold within their sockets. He tried to touch his face and found he couldn't control his hands or even wriggle his fingers.
Shh,
said his mother. Be calm. Be still. He swallowed and found his tongue felt cold, too.
What's going on?
I saved you, said his mother. We saved you.
We?
He blinked again, and more of the room came into focus. He saw he was in some kind of long, low cellar, with a vaulted ceiling, and there were people standing around him, people wearing gray robes and bearing small, flickering candles. But there was something wrong with the walls of the room, and now that he saw it, the ceiling as well. They all seemed to be moving, rippling.
This is a dream, Gregor thought. This must be a dream. What happened to me?
He asked. She sighed slowly. The same thing that's happened to you so often, my dear.
I don't understand,
he whispered. I lost you, she said. But again, you've come back. Gregor lay on the stone slab, breathing weakly. And then, slowly, the memories returned to him. The woman, Estelle Candiano. The knife in his stomach, the swirl of dark water,
I fell,
he whispered.
She stabbed me. Estelle Candiano stabbed me.
I know, she said. You told us already, Gregor.
She didn't really stab me, did she, Mother?
He managed to move his hand and push himself up into a sitting position.
No, no,
his mother chided him. Lay back down, my love. Lay still.
I didn't die, did I, Mother?
He asked. His mind felt thick in his skull, but he found he could think now, just a bit.
That would be mad. I couldn't die and just come back to life.
Enough, said his mother. She reached out and touched the right side of his head with two fingers. Instantly, Gregor fell still. His body seemed to grow numb around him. He could not move, could not blink. He was trapped within himself. Be still, Gregor, said his mother. Be still. Then his skull began to grow hot. Exactly on the right side of his head, right where his mother's fingers touched him. The pain was a low ache at first, but then it got worse and worse. It felt like his very brains were sizzling on the right side of his head. And though he had no memory of this ever happening before, he could remember someone describing a sensation just like this. Sanchia, with Orso and Berenice in the library, saying, "And if the scrivings in my skull get overtaxed, they burn, just burn like hot lead in my bones."
What's going on? Gregor thought desperately. What's happening to me?
Be still, Gregor, said his mother. Be still. He tried to move, raging at his dull, distant body, and found he couldn't. The heat in his skull was unbearable now, like his mother's fingers were red-hot irons. But he could see his mother's face now, barely illuminated by the candle flame. Her eyes were sad, but she did not look surprised or upset or anguished by any of this, really. Rather, it was like this bizarre act was a regrettable duty she was quite familiar with. "What happened to you wounds my heart, my love," she said softly. "But I thank you for coming to us now, when we need you the most." Gregor's heart fluttered in his chest.
No, no, he thought. No, I'm going mad. This is all a dream. This is all just a dream.
Another memory from that same night in the library. Orso, shrugging and saying,
"Oh, it probably wasn't just one merchant house. If one was trying to scribe humans, they all were. It might still be going on for all I know."
No, Gregor thought. No, no, no.
He remembered himself saying aloud, "They could scribe a soldier's mind, make them fearless, make them do despicable things, and then forget they'd ever done them."
No, Gregor thought. No, it can't be. It can't be.
And then, Berenice whispering, "They could scribe you so that you could cheat death itself." And finally, he remembered his own words, spoken to Sanchia beside the gulf, describing what it had been like after Dantua.
"It was like a magic spell had been lifted from my eyes."
His mother watched him, her eyes sad. "You're remembering now," she said. "Aren't you? You usually do about now." He remembered her at the VNZ Foundry, angrily saying, "I killed the project. It was wrong, and we didn't need it anymore, anyway." Which made one wonder, why would you stop trying to scribe humans? Why say you didn't need it anymore?
Because, thought Gregor slowly, you'd already figured out how to do it.
And then, from that same day at Vienzi, he remembered how his mother had wept and told him, "I did not lose you in Dantua. You survived, as I knew you would, Gregor. As I know you always will."
How did I survive Dantua?
He thought, terrified.
Did I survive Dantua, or did I die there?
"I lost your father," said his mother. "I lost your brother,
And I could have lost you in the accident too, my love. Until he came. He came and showed me how to save you, to fix you. So I did. But I had to promise some things in return. More of Gregor's senses returned. He could see now, see the crowd of robed people bearing candles, the curious rippling walls in the darkness. And there was a whispering sound. At first he thought the robed people were whispering, but that wasn't it. It was like they were in some kind of forest with velvety leaves. His ears couldn't make sense of it. His mother shook herself and cleared her throat. Enough! Enough sentiment! Listen to me, Gregor. Her voice became terribly loud in his ears, overpowering his thoughts. Listen to me. Are you hearing me? The fear and rage faded from Gregor's mind. She took her fingers away. It was as if a cold, wet quilt were being laid over his thoughts. He heard himself say quietly,
Yes, I hear you.
You have died, she said. We have saved you again. But you must do something for us. Do you understand? Again his lips moved and the words sprang from his mouth.
Yes, I understand.
You have confirmed something that we have long suspected, she said. Estelle Candiano is the person behind this monstrous plot. Say her name. Now.
Estelle Candiano,
said his voice. His words were mush-mouthed and indistinct. Estelle Candiano is going to try something foolish tonight, said his mother. Something that could endanger us all. We've tried to keep our efforts secret, tried to never act in the open, but she's forced our hand. We must respond, and respond directly, though we must maintain whatever deniability we can. She has something in her possession that she does not understand. Are you hearing me?
Yes,
he said helplessly.
I am hearing you.
His mother grew close. It is a box with a lock.
A box,
he repeated,
with a lock.
We have been looking for this box for some time, Gregor, she said. We have suspected that the Candianos possessed it, but we have been unable to discern exactly where they had it. But now we know. Because of your efforts, we believe Estelle Candiano is keeping it in the mountain. Say that.
In the mountain,
he said slowly. Listen to me, Gregor, she whispered. Listen carefully. There is a devil in this box. Say that. Gregor blinked slowly and whispered,
There is a devil in this box.
Yes, yes, there is, she said. We cannot let Estelle open it. And if she does what she wishes to do tonight, if she elevates herself and becomes a maker, and if she possesses the key, she will have that capability. But we cannot let her release what sleeps within that box. Ophelia swallowed, and if Gregor had the mind for it, he would have seen she was clearly terrified. Once it waged a war to end all wars. We cannot risk such a thing again. We must keep the devil inside the box. Say that.
We must keep the devil inside the box,
whispered Gregor. She leaned close, touching her forehead to his temple. I'm so proud of you for this, my love, she whispered. I do not know if it was your intent or the hand of fate guiding you. But Gregor, I just want you to know that despite everything, I love you. Gregor blinked slowly and mindlessly repeated,
I love you.
Ophelia stood up, her face twisted in shame and disgust, as if pained by his toneless words. Enough. When you have fully recovered, you must fight your way to the mountain, Gregor. Once there, you must find Estelle Candiano, kill her, and then you must take the key and the box. Eliminate anyone who tries to stop you. We have wrought such powerful, beautiful tools to assist you in this task. You must use them to do what you do best, Gregor. To do what we have made you to do. You must fight. She pointed over his shoulder. Gregor turned to look. But as he looked, he realized two things. The first was that he suddenly understood why the walls of the room seemed to be rippling, why there was that fluttering and whispering in his ears. The room was full of moths. Moths swirled and danced and flittered all along the walls, along the ceiling, a sea of white moths flowing around and under and over all of them, their wings like flickering bone. The second thing he realized was that there was someone standing behind him, and he saw them out of the corner of his eye as he turned. Just a glimpse. It was a man. Maybe. A human figure, tall and thin, wrapped in strips of black cloth like a mummified corpse, and wearing a short black cloak. And it was watching him. Gregor turned to look, but in a flash the figure was gone. In its place was a column of moths, a storm of them, a swirling vortex of soft white wings. He stared at the moths. He realized there was something within the column. They were swirling around something, dancing around it, something white. The column of moths slowly lifted like a curtain, and he saw a wooden stand, and hanging upon it a scribe's suit of black armor. Built into one arm was a black, glittering polearm, half-massive axe, half-giant spear. Built into the other was a huge, round shield, and installed behind it, a scribed bolt-caster. And set in the center of the cuirass, a curious black plate. His mother's voice in his ear. "Are you ready, my love? Are you ready to save us all?" Gregor stared at the Lorica. He had seen such things before, and he knew what they were meant for, war and murder. He whispered, "I am ready." Chapter 36. On the other side of the city, at the top of the mountain, Estelle Candiano stared into the mirror and breathed. Slow, deep breaths in and out, filling every part of her lungs. She was doing such delicate work, and the breathing helped steady her hands. If she made one mistake, just one tiny stroke out of place, the whole thing would be ruined. She dipped the stylus in the ink, heavy with particulates of gold, tin, and copper, looked in the mirror, and continued painting symbols onto her bare chest. It was tricky work, doing it backwards, but Estelle had practiced. She'd had all the time in the world to practice, alone and ignored in the back rooms of the mountain for nearly a decade. "The common sigils are the language of creation," she thought as she worked. "But occidental sigils are the language with which God spoke to creation." She dipped the stylus back in the ink and began a new line. "And with these commands, with these authorities, one may alter reality if one wishes, provided you are careful." One stroke more, then another, finishing the sigils. Her left hand was already covered in them, as well as her forearm, upper arm, and shoulder, a twisting, curling lattice of shimmering black symbols, crawling up her arm to swirl about her heart. There was a cough and a gurgle. She looked over her shoulder in the mirror at the figure lying in the bed behind her. A small, wet, beady-eyed man, gasping for breath. "Please stay still, Father," she said softly, "and hold on." Then she glanced at the clock on the wall. 10:20 now. Her eyes darted to the window. The sprawling nightscape of Tavan stretched out below the mountain. Yet all seemed quiet and still. "Captain Rijo!" she called. Footsteps, and then the office door opened. Captain Rijo walked in and saluted. He did not glance at Tribuno Candiano, wheezing and lying there in his soiled sheets. He did not pause at the sight of a bare-breasted Estelle, painting symbols upon her skin. Captain Rijo possessed the virtue that Tavan valued most of all, the ability to ignore what was right in front of his eyes for a huge sum of money.
"Yes, ma'am,"
he said. Estelle sat perfectly still, stylus hovering above her skin. "Is anything happening out there?"
"No, ma'am."
"Not on the Campo?"
"No, ma'am."
"Not in the Commons?"
"Not as far as we can tell, ma'am."
"And our forces?"
"They sit ready and can be deployed with but a word, ma'am."
Her eyes narrowed.
"My word." "Yes, ma'am."
She considered this. "You are dismissed," she said. "Notify me the moment you hear anything. Anything."
"Yes, ma'am."
He smartly turned, strode out, and shut the door. Estelle resumed painting the symbols on her body. Her father gasped, smacked his lips, and fell silent. She made one stroke, then another. Then she froze. Estelle blinked for a moment, then sat up and looked around the room. Empty. Empty except for herself and father, that was, and all of his and Tomas's antiquities sitting on the massive stone desk. "Hmm," she said, troubled. For a moment, she'd suddenly had the strangest and most intense feeling that there had been someone else in the room with them, a third person, standing just behind her, watching her closely. She took a breath, looking around, and then her eye fell on the curious old box that Tomas had stolen before Orso Ignacio could get it, the cracked, ancient, lexicon-looking thing with the gold lock. Estelle Candiano looked at the box, at the lock, at the keyhole. An idea wriggled its way into her mind, wild and insane. "The keyhole is an eye. It watches your every move." "That's mad," she said softly. Then, louder and with more assurance, as if hoping the box might hear her, "That's mad." The box, of course, did nothing to acknowledge this comment. She looked at it for a moment longer, then turned and resumed painting the sigils on her breast. "After my elevation," she thought, "perhaps all these old tools Father dug up will make sense. Perhaps I will crack open that box and see what treasures spill forth." Then her eye paused on the object placed right next to the box, the large, oddly toothed key she'd taken off Orso's man, with the butterfly-shaped head. It had been useful in giving her the last few sigils she'd needed to complete the ritual, but she still didn't know the full extent of its nature. "Or perhaps I don't need to break the box open," she thought. "We shall see, won't we?" Chapter 37. Out in the streets of the Commons, just east of the Candiano walls, Sanchia and the Scrappers moved.
"I wish you could turn those damn shadows off,"
said Giovanni, panting as they ran through the alleys.
"It's like I have a literal blind spot running alongside me."
"Just shut up and run, Gio," said Sanchia. Though she found it odd herself, frankly. Orso had affixed a few samples of the shadow materials to a leather jerkin for her, a slapdash, laughably shoddy solution. But she was now veiled in constant shadow, and it was difficult for her to see what her hands or feet were doing. Finally, they approached the eastern Candiano gates. They slowed and crept along the side of a tottering rookery, peering beyond. Sanchia saw the gleam of helmets in the gate towers, huddling in the windows. Probably a dozen men, each with high-powered springles that could punch a hole in her wide enough to toss a melon through. "Ready?" whispered Claudia.
"I guess," said Sanchia.
"We'll go down this alley," Claudia said, pointing backward, "to draw their eyes away from you. We'll wait 2 minutes, then fire. The instant you see it, you run."
"Got it," said Sanchia.
"Good. Good luck."
Sanchia ran along the rookery to the side facing the path to the Candiano gates. Then she pressed her back to the wood and waited, counting out the seconds. When she got to 2 minutes, she crouched. Any minute now. Then there was a hiss over her shoulder. Something flew high up above the building tops, and then the sky erupted with lights. Sanchia sprinted forward, pumping her arms and legs as hard as she could. She was aware that the scrapper's stun bomb, cleverly attached to a scribed bolt, would only last for a handful of seconds. Even though she was little more than a drop of shadow to the naked eye, that didn't mean she'd be safe without that distraction. The lights behind her died, and then there was a terrific pop. The walls were 20 feet away. The last few strides felt like they took an agonizingly long time. But then she made it, quietly sliding to a stop against their massive stone face. She heard a voice above, from the guard's tower.
What the hell was that?
She waited. She heard murmuring, but little more. Praise God, she thought to herself. Then she carefully, carefully crept along the walls toward the gates. She slid up to them and flexed that odd muscle in her mind. The huge bronze gates erupted with light, two vast rippling panes of white luminescence hanging in space. She looked at them carefully. She could see a hint of their commands within them, their nature, their restrictions. I sure as shit hope I'm right about this, she thought. She took a breath and placed a bare hand on the door.
Tall and strong and resolute, we stand vigilant and watchful, awaiting the messages, awaiting the signs, awaiting the call to begin full pivot inwards. Our hides as hard and dense as cold iron.
She flinched at the enormous sound of it. The Campo gates were undoubtedly the biggest thing she'd attempted to fool yet. Yet she persisted and asked, So you're not allowed to open unless you get the signals?
First the signal of the lieutenant, the twist of crystal,
bellowed the gates.
Then the friction caused by the rope carried by the sergeant at watch. Then all watchmen present must shift their safety switches. Then the sergeant at watch must unlock and crank the...
Okay, question, said Sanchia to the gates. Can you pivot outward? There was a long silence.
Pivot outward?
Asked the gates. Yeah.
There is no indication that this is not possible,
said the gates. Would that count as opening? Would pivoting outward require any of your safety switches?
Checking. All safety and security checks relate specifically to opening, the process of opening inward.
Would you be willing to try opening outward?
There is nothing indicating I should not.
Great, then here's my idea. She told it what to do. It listened and agreed. And then she crept away, down the walls to the next set of gates. And the next. And the next. Giovanni and Claudia crouched in the alley and watched as the tiny dot of shadow silently slipped along the base of the Candiano walls.
Did she do anything?
Said Giovanni, baffled. Claudia pulled out a spyglass and examined the gates.
I don't see anything.
Did we just risk our necks for that damned girl to do nothing? I'll be pissed as hell if that's the case.
We didn't risk our necks, Gio. We just shot a firework into the damned air. Sanchia's the one literally running along the watchtowers.
She peered along the walls as Sanchia stopped at the next gates, paused, and continued on.
Though I honestly have no idea what she's doing.
Gio sighed.
To think of all the mad shit we've had to eat to get to here. We could have left Tavon ages ago, Claudia. We could have been on board a ship right now, headed toward some remote island paradise. A ship full of sailors. Sailors, Claudia. Young, sun-darkened men with thick, rippling shoulders from heaving huge ropes around all day.
Then there was a sharp, warbling scream. Claudia took the spyglass away from her eye.
What the hell was that?
She looked around, but couldn't see anything. Gio, do you see any? Then another scream, one of pure, naked terror. The scream seemed to be coming from the Candiano gates just ahead of them.
Is this part of Sanchia's doing?
Asked Gio. He leaned forward.
Wait. Oh my god, someone's up there, Claudia.
She lifted her spyglass and looked at the Candiano gates. Her mouth fell open.
Holy shit.
A man was standing atop the gate towers of the Candiano gates, his boots perched on the edge of the wall. He was wearing some kind of contraption, like a black suit of armor, except one arm had been modified to be a large, rounded shield, and the other arm had been modified to hold some kind of massive, retractable polearm. Yet, it was difficult to see him clearly, for every movement he made was obscured in darkness. The only reason she could see him at all was because there was a bright scribed light hanging just below him on the wall. It took her a moment to realize what she was looking at. She'd only ever read about such things. A type of particularly notorious shock weapon deployed abroad in the wars.
Lorica,
she said aloud, astonished.
Who the shit is that?
Gio asked.
Did we tell him to be there?
Claudia stared at the man, huge and gleaming in the dark metal contraption. She saw there was a dead body lying on the walls before him, horribly mangled. Presumably, this had been the screamer, whom she now thought had had plenty of reasons to scream.
It can't be, she thought. What the hell is going on?
She watched as the man leapt forward, his body flying up 5, 10, 15 feet.
Definitely a real Lorica, Claudia thought.
And then he crashed down, his polearm licking out like a glittering black whip. She hadn't even noticed that there were guards up on the gate towers with him. Yet then there was a massive splash of blood, and she realized that the man had used his polearm to almost completely vivisect a Candiano guard who'd been sprinting at him, rapier in hand. Three more Candiano guards poured out of the tower onto the gate pathway before the man, a springles raised. The man in the Lorica flicked his shield up just in time to catch the volley of bolts, and he started moving forward, perfectly crouched behind his shield, inching forward toward the three men pouring bolts into him. He stopped, seeming to sense that the men needed to reload. Then he swung his shield arm out, and something happened. It was hard to see. There was just a burst of glimmering metal in the air. The Candiano guards shuddered as if struck by lightning, and they fell. But Claudia saw that their bodies were now curiously rent and torn. She focused on the man in the Lorica as he stood up and saw that his shield was not just a shield. It had been modified so that the back half was also a scribed bolt caster. Probably not accurate over long distances, but nasty up close. Giovanni stared, horrified.
What do we do?
She thought about it, and watched as the man leapt off the top of the Candiano gates into the campo.
Well, she said, he's not our problem, so just sit tight, I guess.
Berenice and Orso huddled in the scribed carriage, staring at the immense Candiano gates ahead. The streets around them were abandoned, like there was a curfew on.
Everything's quiet, said Berenice.
Yes, said Orso. Scrumming creepy as hell, isn't it?
Yes, sir, said Berenice in a small voice.
She craned her head forward, peering at the walls.
I do hope Sanchia's all right.
I'm sure she's fine, said Orso. Maybe.
Berenice said nothing. Orso glanced at her out of the side of his eye.
You and she seem to get along all right.
Ah, thank you, sir.
You do great things together, said Orso. Crack the Cataneo, fabricate whole new scribing definitions in hours. That's something.
She hesitated. Thank you, sir.
He sniffed and looked around.
It's dumb as hell, all this, he said. I keep thinking this could have been avoided. I could have stopped it. If I'd told Tribuno what I thought about his dumb shit. If I'd been more diligent in my pursuits of Estelle. I let my pride get wounded when she turned me down. Pride. It's so often an excuse for people to be weak.
He coughed and said,
Anyways, if a young person were to ask me advice of a personal nature, I'd advise they not sit and passively watch opportunities go by. That's what I'd say if, mind, if a young person were to ask me advice of a personal nature.
There was a long silence.
I see, sir, said Berenice, but not every young person is as passive as you may think.
Aren't they? Said Orso. Good. Very good.
There, said Berenice. Look.
She pointed at the walls. A tiny pool of shadow slipped along the bottom of the white walls up to the huge towering gates.
Is that her?
Said Orso, squinting. The pool of shadow stayed at the base of the gates for a moment, before slipping back down the way it came, disappearing behind a tall rookery.
I don't know, said Berenice. I think so, though.
They waited and waited.
Should something be happening now? Said Orso.
Then they both jumped in fright as a wall of shadow leapt at them out of an alley.
God damn it! Said Sanchia's voice, floating out of the darkness.
It's me! Calm down!
She was panting hard.
Damn, that was a lot of walls and a lot of gates.
She climbed inside. Or so thought she did. It was so dark it was hard to tell. And collapsed in the back of the carriage.
Is it done? Said Orso.
Yeah, gasped Sanchia.
And when does your clever plan start?
Simple, said Sanchia. When you hear the explosions.
Claudia and Giovanni crouched in the shadows of the street, watching the Candiano gates. Then they heard a sound, a clattering, a clanking.
What's that?
Said Gio. Claudia pointed, dumbstruck.
It's the gates, Gio.
They watched as the huge gate doors trembled. They quivered, like they were the skin of a drum that had just received a powerful blow. Then they began rattling, at first quietly, then much, much louder, until it strained their ears, even from where they were.
Sanchia, said Claudia, what the hell did you do?
And then the gates broke. The two halves erupted open, swinging outward with a force like a raging river, snapping all the locks along their middle. They pivoted a full 180 degrees, slamming into the Campo walls and the watchtowers on either side of them, and they struck the walls hard enough to make them crack and start to crumble. A stunning feat, considering the Campo walls had been scribed to be preternaturally durable. For a moment, the two halves of the gates just stood there, smashed into the walls, before the reverberating momentum caused them to slowly, slowly topple forward, which pulled down a lot of the walls with them. They slammed into the ground hard enough to send a fine spray of mud and dust surging throughout the entire city block. Claudia and Giovanni coughed and covered their faces. The commons lit up with cries and shouts, but this wasn't loud enough to cover up a new sound, a rattling and clattering from the next set of gates, just south of the fallen walls.
Oh, shit, said Gio. She did it to all of them, didn't she?
Orso and Berenice sat up, startled, as the immense crack echoed through the night skies. I told the gates opening outward didn't count as opening, said Sanchia in the back seat. The hard part was getting them to wait. She sniffed. Should be, one every minute or so for a while. In the mountain, Estelle Candiano heard the crash and looked up.
What in hell? She said aloud.
She looked down at herself. She'd finished covering her arm and chest in the appropriate sigils, and she did not want to smudge them any. Still, that was worth investigating. She walked over to the windows and looked out at the dark ramble of Tavan. She immediately saw what had happened. One of the northeastern gates appeared to have totally collapsed, which should have been impossible. Those gates had been designed by her father. They should have withstood a damned monsoon. What in all the... Then, as she watched, there was a tremendous crack, and the gate south down the wall from that one suddenly burst outward. The walls around it cracked and began to crumble apart. Her mouth twisted with rage. "Or so," she spat. "This is you, isn't it? What in hell are you trying to pull?" The intense crack shot through the commons with a curiously steady rhythm, like a lightning storm touching down every minute. Orso flinched each time. Soon the sky above the eastern campo was a haze of dust, and the commons were screaming in panic.
"Anshia," said Orso quietly, "did you take down the entire eastern walls?"
"I should have, when this is all over with," said Sanshia. "Should give all those Campo's soldiers a lot to defend. And it'll be somewhere far from here. A decent distraction."
A distraction?" he cried. Girl, you scrumming killed the Candiano Campo. You've killed my old house in one night."
"Eh," said Sanshia. "I just aired it out a bit." Estelle Candiano threw on a white shirt just as Captain Rijo threw open the door and charged in.
"What in hell is going on out there, Captain?" she demanded.
"I do not know, ma'am," he said, "but I came to ask if I could mobilize our reserves in order to investigate and respond."
There was another sharp crack and the rumble of falling walls. Captain Rijo cringed ever so slightly.
But what do you think is happening, Captain?"
"In my professional estimation,"
he thought about it,
"it would appear to be a siege, ma'am. Many gates destroyed so that we have to split our forces."
"Damn it all," she said.
She looked at the clock. She had just over 30 minutes until midnight.
"I'm so close," she thought. "I'm so damned close."
"Ma'am,"
said Captain Rijo,
"the reserves?"
"Yes, yes," she snapped. "Throw everything we have at them. Whatever the hell is happening, I want it stopped, now."
He bowed.
"Yes, ma'am."
Then he turned and smartly strode away, shutting the door behind him. Estelle walked over to the windows and stared out at the damage. The northeastern half of the campo was almost completely obscured with smoke now. She imagined she could hear screaming from somewhere out in the dark. "Whatever is happening," she thought, "I just need it to last more than 30 minutes. After that, nothing else will matter." The two scrappers watched as the Candiano Campo walls dissolved, bit by bit. "Well," said Claudia, "I think we're done here, yeah?"
"I think so."
Giovanni wrinkled his nose.
"Now to file all of Orso's paperwork, yes?"
She sighed. "Yes, and to buy his property. Off from one mad plan and on to the next one."
"You know, we could just take the money he gave us and run,"
said Giovanni lightly. "True," said Claudia. "But then, everyone else would die."
"Well, yes. I guess we wouldn't want that."
Together, they fled into the darkness. Chapter 38 Sanshia leaned forward as the gates ahead began to rattle. "Good," she said. "I told them to go last. The second those things pop open and the way is clear, you speed in as fast as you can, all right?"
"Oh, shit," said Orso.
A bead of sweat ran down his temple as he gripped the pilot's wheel. "Don't go too fast," said Sanshia, "because there's going to be shrapnel. Get me?"
You are really not helping here," snapped Orso.
Just go when I say go. They watched the gates rattle, tremble, and shake, and then, like all the others, they burst open, ripping apart the walls on either side. A massive tsunami of dust flooded toward them. Sanchia shielded her eyes with one hand. She was now mostly blind, but she could still see with her scrying sight. She waited a moment, then she said, "Go, go now."
"But I can't see," said Orso, sputtering. "Orso, just scrumming, go, go."
Orso shoved the acceleration lever forward, and the carriage took off, hurtling into the dust. Sanchia squinted and peered ahead, reading the scrivings written into the buildings on either side of the street, glimpsing the massive, rippling landscape of designs and sigils encoded into everything. "The road curves slightly to the left up ahead," said Sanchia. "No, not that much. There, yes, good." Finally, they broke free of the dust cloud. Orso exhaled with relief.
"Oh, thank God."
"No soldiers in sight," said Berenice. "Streets are clear." "All on the eastern wall," said Sanchia, "just as I'd hoped."
"And we're almost there."
Orso peered out the window at the street names.
"Just a little farther. Here, here's the spot."
He slammed on the brakes.
"Exactly a mile and a half from the mountain."
They stared ahead at the vast dome rising among the towers. Then they all scrambled out. Sanchia started affixing the gravity rig to her body, and Orso checked his twinned heating chamber.
"Everything looks good here," he said.
"Turn it on," said Sanchia.
"I'll turn it on once you're ready," he said, "just to be safe."
She paused, glancing at him, but continued buckling on the gravity rig. "Ah, damn, I hope I have this dumbass thing on right," she muttered. "Let me see," said Berenice. She reviewed the various straps, fussing and tutting and adjusting them. "I think you're set," she said. "Except perhaps this one here." She tightened one buckle on Sanchia's shoulder. Thoughtlessly, Sanchia reached up and grabbed her hand, her own bare palm gripping Berenice's fingers. Berenice paused. The two looked at each other. Sanchia swallowed. She wondered what to say and how to say it, how to articulate how impossible touch had been for so long, real, genuine human touch, and how, after tonight, she wanted to touch no one but Berenice. How hungry she felt for Berenice's enthusiastic glow, this raw desire to snatch a piece away for herself, like a demigod stealing fire from a mountaintop. But before she could start to fumble with the words, Berenice just said, "Make it back." Sanchia nodded. "I'll try," she said hoarsely. "Don't try." Berenice leaned in and suddenly kissed her, quite hard. "Do it, all right?" Sanchia stood there for a moment, dazed. "All right." Orso cleared his throat.
"Listen, I don't want to interject here, but we are dealing with, you know, the apocalypse or thereabout."
"Yeah, yeah," said Sanchia. She released Berenice and took stock of her gear. Some stun bombs, darts, and a long, thin length of rope, and breathed deep. "I'm ready." Orso turned the bronze dial on the side of the heating chamber. The gravity rig grew bright on Sanchia's chest. "Shit," she said. "Oh, boy."
"It's still working, yes?" said Orso anxiously.
"Please provide location and density of mass," chirped the rig. "Yeah," said Sanchia. "It's working all right."
"Then do it! Now, now, now!"
Sanchia took another deep breath and told the rig, "Location of mass is up. Density is of 6 Earths.
"Great," said the rig. "Enforce the effects now?"
"No, enforce the effects the instant my feet leave the ground."
"Sure."
She situated her feet and dipped her legs down into a crouching position. As she did, the gravity around her changed. Things began to float around her, pebbles, grains of sand, shreds of leaves.
"Berenice?" said Orso nervously.
"I believe this is upthrust," Berenice said. "Like,
step into a bathtub and the water level rises? I didn't have time to control for that.
Shit, said Sanchia. Here I go. Then she sank lower, then jumped.